Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us in this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Dr. Matthew Bunsen joins us today, and for all of you who like keeping up with church news and current events in light of church teaching, you will be intrigued. Dr. Matthew Bunsen has been on the ground since just about the time Pope Francis passed away till essentially right now. I believe he might be coming home soon if he's not already home, and he's got plenty to update us, not only in terms of his experience there, but also in terms of knowing about the Holy Father. One of the questions that has arisen about Pope Leo XIV that many people have been curious about is, he is now the first American-born pope, and America has international taxes. So what will become of his taxes? Will the IRS finally and formally be able to say, we received the tax return report of the Holy Father, which would actually crack me up quite a bit. But what will become of his citizenship? Those are legitimate questions, and Dr. Matthew Bunsen reports from Rome about this. Oh, and he's preparing for Pope Leo XIV's inauguration mass as well. We go on from there to speak with Bill Schmidt. Anyone tallying subject areas where Pope Leo XIV is on the same wavelength as his predecessor will find consistent and compelling themes in the Vatican's 2025 message for World Day of Social Communications. We talk about it with Bill Schmidt. One of the things we are constantly trying to highlight, however, is to not try to pigeonhole the Holy Father. Inasmuch as every day, every one of us is learning how to be Catholic, learning how to be saintly, the Holy Father right now is undergoing a different transition. Pope Leo XIV is now learning how to be Pope the way God is calling him to be Pope. He is owed our prayers, our fidelity, our support, and our devotedness as his covenant spiritual children. And then finally, we speak with Christopher Shannon. When historians debate church history, especially the Second Vatican Council, they tend to make a key mistake. They seek to align the church with America rather than align America with the church. And this has been particularly a problem, especially since the 60s. And so with Christopher Shannon, we talk about why this is a problem. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, May 15th. It's the Feast of St. Isidore the Farmer. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Limiting the power of federal judges is a question facing the Supreme Court. It's all related to an executive order from President Trump that aims to end birthright citizenship, generally accepted as the law under the Constitution's 14th Amendment. The case brought before the High Court today isn't directly about the constitutionality of the order, but the scope with which lower courts can issue nationwide injunctions. President Trump is now in the United Arab Emirates for the next stop in his tour through the Middle East. Trump toured a famous mosque before having dinner at the presidential palace this evening. The president arrived after visiting Saudi Arabia and Qatar, where he announced business deals and agreements potentially worth more than $1 trillion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky isn't expected to engage in peace talks with Russia's delegation after President Vladimir Putin decided to skip the meeting. Putin previously suggested Moscow would be open to direct negotiations with Ukraine to discuss the three-year war, but then later announced that a lower-level delegation would make the trip. Earlier today, President Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One that nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together. And an original copy of the Magna Carta has been unearthed. The New York Times says experts determine the parchment that's been sitting in a Harvard library for 80 years turns out to be one of the originals from the 1300s. It was purchased for $27 in 1946, but it could be worth millions. From the Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm joined by my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we are talking about current events and church news. Matthew, as if there's not enough by way of news globally, you've been hit with a plethora of events ever since the passing of the late Pope Francis and now the election of Pope Leo XIV. So share with us how you've been and what's going on the ground.
Well, I'm doing very well. It's always a privilege to be able to cover monumental events like this in the life of the church, but also to stay focused as well. That, as a Catholic, I like to think myself as a dedicated Catholic, to be able to experience these events in such close proximity to their actually happening is deeply moving spiritually. And I think it's a reminder, too, that all of us as Catholics have a duty to pray for our Holy Father, to pray for the Church, and to work for the benefit of both.
Yeah. And in working for the benefit of both, one of the things that I've greatly appreciated about the coverage of EWTN and your own contributions is we've been very careful to only speak about those things for which we have actual information of. And we've shied away from overt speculation of which pundits with their opinions are running rampant across the world right now.
That's very fair. Certainly in the weeks prior to the passing of Pope Francis, there were many different types of speculation regarding his health. And, of course, he never did fully recover from his long stint in Gemelli Hospital. And then with his passing to follow the Novendiales, the 9 days of mourning after the funeral, and then the ramp-up to the conclave. It's a time-honored reality that in an interregnum you will have an immense amount of speculation, ideas that are floated, names that are discussed, who's up, who's down, who's rising, who's falling. But all of that is ultimately secondary to the decision that the College of Cardinals had to make, and I think we can say that the one that they did pick, in this case, Cardinal Robert Prevost, while his name was mentioned on a number of occasions, including by us in our coverage, I think most people tended to overlook him as a real serious possibility simply because, to put it bluntly, he was an American.
I have to be very, very humbly honest. I didn't see it coming, and I await to see the grand plan of the Holy Spirit in leading the church in this light, but also about what the Holy Spirit is trying to tell us here in America. Because I think we shouldn't just rejoice because he's American. I think we should take it as a kind of warning and a wake-up call for the church in America to rise up in fidelity.
Yeah, I think you're making a very important point. First, if we go back and we look at the decision-making on the part of the College of Cardinals, in the ramp-up again to the actual conclave, you had 12 separate sessions of so-called general congregations among the cardinals. And if you began exploring exactly what they were talking about, you could begin to see a list of things that's really preeminent to them, facing the church. Things, for example, like the restoration of law in the church, not that it was lawless, but a sense of greater clarity in terms of law and the implementation of it, synodality and its relationship to things like collegiality, peace in the world, the fact that the church is called to be missionary, the fact that there are many divisions in the church today, all of these things that the cardinals are facing, either in their own environments or in other parts where they know this is happening. The persecution of the church, for example, is everywhere that you look. It depends simply on how severe it is. So as you looked at these lists of things, one candidate really did begin to emerge as somebody who, to use that old phrase, checked the boxes. And that was Cardinal Prevost. The issue, however, was that he was somewhat dismissed simply because it seemed so implausible that the cardinals would choose an American. We are, after all, in the United States, the world's major superpower. And it simply didn't occur to a lot of people this is possible. But also looking back in hindsight, not only did he check many of the boxes as a canon lawyer, as somebody who had led the missions for decades, as a member of the Augustinian order, as somebody who had served in Rome, the College of Dicastery for Bishops, and somebody who had also this extensive experience, obviously, in the United States, he filled so many of the boxes, checked them. And yet, he was also ultimately acceptable as an American precisely for those reasons, that he had been out of the country for so long, that he has Peruvian citizenship.
Right.
He is somebody who bridges two different continents, South America or Latin America and North America, but he also bridges the Americas with Europe.
And thereby, we see a kind of, I use the term universality, actually, is the term I'm looking for. We see a kind of universality to his call to the papacy, and therefore, properly speaking, a kind of Catholicity to it. And in these little bits, I'm actually seeing the wisdom the Holy Spirit guided our Father Cardinals into.
Yeah, I think as they got to know him, Colonel Timothy Dolan, in an editorial in the New York Post, observed that he really didn't know Cardinal Prevost very well. Certainly when he arrived in Rome, he'd heard of him, of course. He had some dealings with him in the Dicastery for Bishops. But as the weeks and days and weeks passed after the death of Pope Francis, he was asked, and he mentioned this in his opinion piece in the New York Post, he was asked, what do you know about Prevost? Mm-hmm. So he became increasingly curious himself. And as he put it, he came away very impressed with his own dealings. So clearly what happened in the conclave, with that in the lead up to it and then on the day it started, there was a certain coalescing around his candidacy, not something apparently that Cardinal Prevost himself was involved in. But the cardinals around him who looked at him and looked at, shall we say, the alternatives, realized that this was a candidate who'd been sitting in front of them all along and who ultimately then really was able to galvanize the vast majority of the cardinals. It is believed that he received over 100 of the 133 votes that were cast in the conclave. So this is a consensus candidate, not somebody who simply got by with 89 votes.
That's right. It's terrible that some secular perspectives immediately started touting him as the compromise candidate. The fact is, we weren't in the conclave. We shouldn't. It's uncharitable. But before we end the segment, Matthew, just very quickly, I think a lot of people are concerned that the IRS will now have purview to the papal finances and his citizenship as well. What do we know? What has happened historically, and what might happen now?
Well, he is head of state, so there's that. He is somebody who technically possesses three passports. He has an American passport as somebody who's native born in the United States. He is also somebody who has a passport for Peru, because he's a naturalized citizen. And as a member of the College of Cardinals and a member of the Roman Curia, he also had a Vatican passport. I will leave it to the diplomats now to decide what becomes of all of the passports. Something tells me he's not going to need them for the rest of his life as the head of the Vatican. But I think this is an indicator, though, of just how truly internationalized he was in leading the path on this journey to the papacy.
And thereby, we have a lot of hope in the fact that that spirit will continue. And again, he is a man for such a time as this, and he's owed our prayers and devotion. So preparing for his inauguration mass, what can you tell us very quickly?
Yeah, well, the installation or inaugural mass will take place on Sunday, 10 a.m. Rome time. And it will include some of the great features, such as the receiving of the pallium and also the ring of the fishermen. This is an important mass, but let's remember the day he was elected and accepted, he had full universal authority in the church. So it's not like a presidential inauguration.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Matthew. Thank you for making the time despite the time difference and everything.
Yeah, great to be with you. God bless.
My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. He's on the ground in Rome right now covering events as they lead up to Pope Leo XIV's inauguration mass. Stay tuned for the next segment. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Catholic Charities of Shiawassee and Genesee Counties have been providing health and creating hope since 1941. It's the generosity of donors that allows them to provide necessary services such as their warming center, which provides refuge and comfort to thousands in our community. They also offer hot meals in their soup kitchens and help families make ends meet in their community closet. Even the smallest donation makes a meaningful difference. Join us in their mission by giving a donation at CatholicCharitiesFlint.org.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Anyone tallying subject areas where Pope Leo XIV is on the same wavelength as his predecessor will find consistent and compelling themes in the Vatican's 2025 message for the World Day of Social Communications. We talk about it with Bill Schmidt. Bill is a Catholic journalist. He blogs for Father Robert Spitzer's Marger Center for Reason and Faith, and he reports for diocesan newspapers in New York State. He also writes on his Substack, Phronesis in Pieces. Bill, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh, very fine. It's a pleasure to join you, Marcus.
I want to acknowledge the elephant in the room that I've been speaking about, that I'm also glad you highlighted, which is it's so easy for especially secular pundits to try to argue for some kind of a disconnect from the papacy of Francis to the papacy of Pope Leo XIV, but to do so is to demonstrate ignorance both of the men but also of the office of the papacy. I'd like to begin there.
Well, that's true. It's kind of imposing the political paradigm of the U.S. and some other countries about, well, if one person leaves and another person comes in, it's assumed that there's going to be switcheroos and a totally different style and substance, and that's not the Catholic Church.
Yep. And in fact, I think you just highlighted yet another way in which we can tend to be Americanistic about our thoughts of global issues and movements and, in this case, the papal office and therefore the operations of the Catholic Church.
That's right. That's right. That's such a joy about what was just being said, that this man is a citizen of three different lands and has seen so much. And talk about the need for better communications. He's put it into action in communicating with his Augustinian confreres and as a bishop and in so many ways. So needless to say, as someone who's written about World Communications Day messages in the past, I was wondering what Pope Leo might be saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he even actually, I think his first address was to journalists. So he kind of made his mini World Communications Day message just a few days ago.
And Thereby, when we look at the way he thinks, how he speaks, the addresses that he gives, I think he's demonstrating very clearly to us from his very first homily onwards that this is a man who is articulate because he's careful about systematic thought and systematically yes. presenting that well. Tell us a little about that.
Oh, well, you know, that's one thing that he said in remarks from the Catholic News Service, that we need to he sees all as a challenge of formation, just as much as anything else, because he's recommending to journalists and to the church that we do a better job of forming critical thinkers.
Right.
And the American media especially are so geared toward entertainment and easy answers and easy headlines that formation, information is formation. We forget that. And
yes.
that's why I liked so much your thoughts yesterday, which really elevated the whole challenge of communication to that higher level. You know, communication can even sink to the level of desecration, where we're always forming ourselves. And Leo said that communication is a builder of culture and of spaces for discussion and debate. And Americans tend to use communication as a forum for clickbait.
Yep. To quote Neil Postman, we've amused ourselves to death, and in the face of this, we globally, especially here in the post-Christian declining West, we have allowed ourselves to adopt a relativistic way of viewing the truth, a relativistic epistemology. And so to answer that, you highlighted not just how Benedict does this, Benedict XVI, but also Francis and now Pope Leo XIV, that primary to their concern is the intersection and therefore engagement of reason and the faith in light of everything that the culture throws at us.
That's right. It has to be a very a balanced approach. Pope Francis, in the 2025 message, which has already been released, even though the World Day of Communications will be June 1st, he emphasized hope and kindness and gentleness in communication. And what's nice is that Pope Leo is, among his many skills, a diplomat, and really is very keen to the audience for communication, not just the producer or the newsmaker leading communication. And we do have to be very sensitive to that.
Yep. And because of that, we can also understand that in that sensitivity you just called us to, Francis, Benedict didn't encounter the digital realm as much as Francis had to, and Pope Leo is going to have to encounter the artificial intelligence realm more than Francis ever did. But all of them, all three of them at least, have spoken about the need to make sure we're not shying away from culture, but encountering it head on.
That's right. And the whole a series of 59 World Communication Day messages has its roots in the Vatican II document, Inter Mirifica, where the council did note that, hey, you know, there are so many amazing things happening in communications technology that Catholics have to be very much involved in it and very much involved in encouraging Catholic and Christian values into a technology that can very easily get out of hand.
Yep.
And we've never seen the risk like we do now of technology getting out of hand. Pope Francis spoke very, very well and very caringly about that danger because he's a personalist and he doesn't want computers to replace people.
Yep.
Pope Leo, I'm sure, is going to to follow that with even greater technical and administrative precision.
Yep, I agree with you, Bill. And like you mentioned, Pope Francis saw the alarming concern that this was going to pose, not just to the church and the faith, but human existence. And so Pope Leo, I believe, is going to greatly encounter that, and therefore he's going to face that head on and lead us to do the same. And because of that, considering dialoguing the world's culture in this artificial machine learning sphere, talk about how Benedict, Francis, and clearly Pope Leo have issues like evangelization, the church's role in addressing modern-day challenges. Talk about how this is at one of their focal points of their papal work.
Well, yes. The whole idea of truth in charity mm-hmm. has to be combined with truth in clarity.
Yep.
And Pope Benedict was very much a theologian of great clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of our relativistic culture, as you say, is losing a sense of clarity, because if everybody's truth is the same, there's no need for pinning things down. And
yeah.
Indeed, a lot of people see the need to, for the sake of clarity, to shut down other points of view, which they might only confuse us.
Yep. Bill, always a joy to connect with you. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you very much, Marcus. All the best.
My guest, Bill Schmidt, Catholic journalist, blogger, reporter, and he writes on his own Substack, Phronesis in Pieces. And we've been talking about continuities from the Benedict Papacy into the Francis Papacy into now the Leonine Papacy. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, Kathy Ann. In honor of our beloved mother and grandmother, who passed away during the Easter season and always dreamed of being a teacher. Pauline's roots were in Finland, where they highly respected educators. Grandma handed out gift cards because she knew teachers weren't paid here well in the U.S. She'd be so proud of her granddaughter, who now nurtures the hearts and minds of schoolchildren.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
When Pope Leo XIV was first revealed to the world, Ave Maria Radio carried it live.
We see movement on the balcony. The doors are opening.
Abemus Papam.
Pope Leo XIV.
The former Cardinal Robert Prevost of Chicago in the United States.
You can feel the emotion in the crowd.
Long live the Pope.
The good of art, we are told, is in the social or political commentary that it provides. Or for others, art exists for the sake of arousing emotion, or perhaps for the expression of emotion. But everyone, it seems, wants art to do something. Not just painting and sculpture, but literature too is supposed to justify itself by likewise providing us with political and social themes for analysis. Does anyone, anymore, just look at a painting and say, "My, this is beautiful"? And I'm very much afraid that the most perfect art form ever, the human person, is being required to justify himself, to prove himself useful. Of course, if it seems he won't be useful, we have various pills and clinics. Or, if he has outlived his usefulness, we have places where he can be tucked out of the way. But consider this. Maybe we could once again learn how to recognize the simple beauty of being. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. When historians debate church history, especially Vatican II, they tend to make a key mistake. They seek to align the church with America. This is particularly true of European and, of course, especially American historians. Rather than align America with the church, we're joined by Dr. Christopher Shannon. He's a member of the history department at Christendom College, where he interprets a narrative of Christian history from its foundations in the Old Testament and its heroic beginnings in the Church of Martyrs, down through the ages to the challenges of the postmodern world. He's also the author of this new piece in Catholic World Report entitled History and Nationalism. Chris, thank you for making the time. How are you?
Oh, Marcus, thank you for having me. I'm doing pretty well. It's the semester's winding down here. I got my senior grades in, and we have graduation tomorrow. So busy weekend, but good time of the year.
Well, I'm glad you're making the time to have this important conversation, despite how packed your schedule is. I know graduation's no small feat. And considering that, we're still very much in the wake of losing one pope while we've been gifted with the gift of another. And we're not short of pundits all trying to opine into the void. They're all trying to fill the epistemological gap that they think the loss of one pope in the beginning of the next papacy will leave. In the face of this, I want to ask you to speak to what historians in general, but especially here in America, and Catholic historians will face in light of nationalism that you highlight.
Well, I think a lot of the punditry, of course, has been political, right? Right or left? And where does he fit into the American categories? And, you know, unfortunately, that's, as I kind of mentioned in the piece,
Have you heard the whole thing about him being a Republican and whatnot? They're opining that way. It's just garbage.
Yeah. But it's a kind of a symptom of, in part, a tendency, at least certainly among Catholic intellectuals in America to try to fit the church into American categories. And, there's good historical reasons for that, because for most of the history of America, the Catholics were this outsider group. They were vilified. Mm-hmm. They were seen as un-American. And so some of the figures I write about in that Catholic Report piece, I sympathize with their efforts to try to just make the case, hey, we belong, we can be good citizens and all. But the problem is when you get from that kind of basic level to higher principles, and that's when things get tricky, where we start to the reason we belong is because we're just like fill in the blank. We're just like a certain political regime. And that certainly is not the case with America, with the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church has many principles, authorities and such that are very distinct from the American political order and non-Catholic Americans. And I think there's the danger of we lose that distinction. And that's, most obvious, of course, in the political spin on so much of the commentary. I think what I hope comes from our first American Pope, or is he an American Pope, the parts that I was most heartened by were the parts, the biographical parts on his background. where he comes from, and he's kind of he's just a few years older than me, but of the kind of last generation of those urban ethnic Catholics. He's Chicago, I was in Rochester, New York, but that's the world that really made the church in America, and that world does not fit into our current national political categories at all. And so my hope is that as people try to figure out who this guy is, who this Pope Leo the 14th is, they'll start with like, well, where did he come from? Because if me, you know, if I want to know who somebody is, that's the first question I ask. Where are you from? You know? And, I hope that, again, as people try to solve the riddle of Leo, a riddle of their own making maybe, but that they will look more into that world that shaped him.
I think the piercing of this question of the riddle, Chris, is also unfortunately plagued by that continued question we have as Americans. Like you've mentioned, it's almost come to a point where it's impossible for us to view everything in the world outside of the lens of identity politics and therefore the sociopolitical divide. And this is a real tension between the Catholicity of the church and a kind of American national identity.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in some sense, identity politics is a problem, but it's a symptom of the weakness of actual real identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ideology. Whereas before, Catholics kind of knew who they were, not in this general sense, but like the world that Pope Leo came out of. You know, it's I live in this place. I'm a parishioner at such and such. There's this famous kind of anecdote, I guess, if you will, from earlier time. In the early 20th century, where particularly in Chicago, people would, they would ask you, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
They'd say, what parish are you from? You know, that the parish identity in cities like Chicago, and I'd say to some degree where I grew up in Rochester, New York as well, like that was your identity as a Catholic. I mean, yes, of course, you know, the Pope and the teachings and everything, but it was very much your identity was rooted in a particular parish. Sometimes, you know, there would be rivalries between them. In my neighborhood, we had Sacred Heart and then Holy Rosary, but, you know, they played against each other in CYO basketball or something. So sworn enemies, you know. Holy Rosary rings the bell, Sacred Heart can go to hell. And so, friendly rivalries. But still, it did make a difference. I've heard stories from people I grew up with where when they the girls would go, when they go to the Catholic high school, what the nuns would, first thing they ask them, okay, well, where are you from? You know, and then so this one woman said, I'm from Holy Rosary, but she had just moved there. And the other Holy Rosary girl's like, no, you're not. You're not from Holy Rosary. You know, so it can get kind of petty in some ways. But to me, nowhere near as petty as political punditry can get.
Yep.
I'd prefer that kind of local identity to the national one. Because, again, the Catholics shaped the local world in which they lived, where the national world is shaped by other ideologies and other forces in which Catholics tried to find a place. And I think in an earlier time, maybe again through the middle of the 20th century, when they did in the 30s and 40s kind of make that leap into the national scene, I think they put their own stamp on it. And so there was something about, particularly if you're in the North, of course, you know, the Democratic Party was northern and southern, and the South is very different. But the Northern Democratic Party was overwhelmingly shaped by Catholic political leaders who weren't, you know, fighting popes and, you know, encyclicals right and left, maybe, but kind of gave it, I'd say, a particularly Catholic synthesis of being both culturally conservative and by the terms of the time, economically liberal. You know, they were New Deal people. And that, you know, there's always the danger of using those terms, liberal conservative. I would say it's more like, no, they put forward a kind of a holistic Catholic vision of economics and culture. And that's, you know, that was strong and powerful and compelling for, you know, the middle decades of the 20th century. And then, you know, and a lot of other things changed after during the 1960s, and there's, you know, a lot of different things going on there, but I think that for our purposes and for part of the reason for writing that article was that one of the things that happened in the 1960s is that Catholics lost their distinctiveness.
Yep.
So then they started to line up on left and right, and then eventually started to write histories to justify those political positions.
With the continued diminishing, especially during the 60s, of the hold of Christendom and especially the church on the collective moral ethos of the culture, especially here in the U.S., you see that vacuum, right, that ethical moral vacuum, and therefore the general cultural vacuum that needs to be filled. And unfortunately, the secular religiosity for America has become identity politics. Now, in the face of that, help us make the distinction between nationalism versus a virtuous patriotism.
Yeah, that's the one. Whenever I raise the criticism, that's people always go back to patriotism.
And, right.
There is certainly, patriotism is love of country, right?
Yeah. We'll have to pause there, Chris, but we'll pick up on the other side of the break. This is an intriguing conversation that needs to be paid attention to. My guest is Dr. Christopher Shannon, member of the History Department at Christendom College. We're talking about history and nationalism. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Spring into mowing season with a new Cub Cadet lawn tractor from Weingarts. We've been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment since 1945. Cub Cadet XT Enduro Series tractors are engineered to offer the best combination of quality, value, and performance. Cub Cadet lawn and garden tractors offer comfort and year-round versatility. Stop by our stores to help find your next Cub Cadet or visit us online at Weingarts.com. From our family to yours, thank you for letting us serve you.
Weingarts, everything.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
We have a Pope. I'm Dr. Marcus Peter, and on behalf of Ave Maria Radio, I want to echo our sentiments of rejoicing in the benevolence of our Lord in continuing to grant us a Holy Father to shepherd the bark of Peter. Upon this rock, Christ built his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail. Let us give thanks to our Lord and also pray for Robert Cardinal Prevost, who is now Pope Leo XIV, the 267th successor to the Holy Chair of Peter. God's hand remains upon his covenant family on earth. Deo gratias. Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Dr. Christopher Shannon. He's a member of the History Department at Christendom College. We're talking about America's history and, in fact, the history of the Catholic Church in America in light of nationalism and how we ought to reorient ourselves along the lines of what the Magisterium calls us to live by. So, Chris, you were starting to tell us about making proper distinctions here between nationalism versus this very rightly virtuous sense of patriotism.
Yes. Listen closely. All will be revealed. patriotism, love of country, yes, but patria, what kind of a country is a patria? Patria
right.
is a father, right? And this distinct thing about America is that America was not founded on that kind of patria, the king, whatever, the family, and the people, a people of blood or culture or common descent and common history. America was founded on ideas, and that's what makes the American situation a bit more confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could understand how a Frenchman, even with all of the Enlightenment ideology of the French Revolution, the French Revolution ended up producing French nationalism. Come out of just a general universal ideology. It came out France had been around since, for 1,000 years or so. And so they could see themselves in that tradition, and it gets transformed certainly with the revolution and such. But an Englishman can see himself as an Englishman. Actually, I'll stick to the French example because I have a personal anecdote there. A friend of mine was he was in love with a French woman. He moved to France to live there for several years, and then ultimately she it didn't work out. But one of the things she said on the way to the breakup was like, "Oh, Stephen, you will never be French." it takes several generations to be French, whereas in America, it's like, once you lose that stupid accent, you're just one of us like everybody else. And that it's because America doesn't have that kind of patria, that family notion that traditional countries do. And not just Europe, but the world over. So that makes it more difficult. In America, we pledge allegiance to a flag. What is that? The flag is not a father. And to the republic for which it stands. All these ideas are what we're pledging allegiance to. Whereas a Frenchman doesn't. The revolution complicates things, but the Frenchman pledges his allegiance to France. It is a patria in a more kind of traditional sense. And so to just go back to America, my parents are of the World War II generation, and I completely understand the tremendous moment of, we'll call it patriotism for the time, just this love of America, this great event, and we won the good war and all that. But then it's like, well, what are we loving here?
Yeah,
and it was not a war of conquest. It was not a war to show that America was the greatest nation in the world. It was a war for freedom, for equality, for liberty. And then, what do those things mean? And the problem is, their meaning has changed constantly throughout history. And we can look at the most obvious change after World War II, something like abortion. Well, that's not real freedom. Well, I mean, I agree, but as a Catholic, I can agree. But from America, like, show me where the real freedom in American history is, because at our founding, real freedom was compatible with slavery. Okay, we fight a war and we end that. But then, things change after the Civil War as well. And it's that kind of constant flux in the meaning of these ideas, which are very different from, like, if you're, if you're a member of a family, your family may change, but the actions of your siblings, whatever, your relatives may change, but nothing changes the fact that you were in that family.
Right.
Whereas if you're pledging allegiance to ideas, well, unfortunately, as a historian, I can see that those ideas are always changing. So what exactly are you pledging allegiance to?
Mm-hmm.
And what it usually ends up being is like, well, this moment in time. Like, if you're conservative, you're pretty much pledging allegiance to 1950s America. If you're a liberal, you're pretty much pledging allegiance to 1960s America.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics have to get beyond or above the fray of that kind of flux and understand that, unlike America, where ideas and meanings are changing all the time, we have, compared to any other institution in the West, a pretty remarkable continuity in our understanding.
Yep.
Of these ideas, and so that's where we should kind of plant our flag, if you will, first, and certainly offer that to America, and invite America to see that, your history is one of constant flux and transition and change, but we have a tradition here that has continuity. There's not like unchanging, but it certainly has continuity, and the change is coherent and understandable, whereas the changes in American history have been very, very abrupt, from slavery yes to slavery no, from universal human rights and dignity to abortion of children on demand. These things, there's too much flux for me to be confidently say, yes, that's my country. And so that's okay for Catholics. That shouldn't be a big problem. And again, unless you have your whole faith invested in the country, then if you don't have that, then what you can take comfort in is like, okay, our faith tradition is where our heart is, that is where the stability is, and yes, we are Americans, and we should do everything we can to make America the best country that it can be. But I think the way we do that is to share our faith,
yep.
not to tell America that it is, you know, was born in perfection and is just becoming more perfect, you know, all the time. But I think there's always been a sense that for Catholics to be critical in that way, you know, they would just be dismissed or attacked, or as, you know, in the old days it would be like, oh, you're trying to take over America. You want the Pope to rule America.
Right.
And in our own day, there's less of that, but then it'll be like, you're imposing your religion on us. And so Catholics don't want to be accused of that. And so they end up doing is, you know, putting on a liberal or conservative mask to say, oh, no, it's not my religion. It's my politics. And then what happens in that process is that the Catholic tradition, our beliefs get distorted because they have to be shoehorned into these public masks that we adopt in order to not be accused of imposing our faith on other people. And that's, you know, I would like to see that change in Catholics, be more confident as Catholics in public.
One of the ways in which you see this unfortunate grand capitulation of that flux and therefore Catholics putting on a massive mask is, you highlighted this, the idea of a Catholic University conference in July of 1967, the document that comes about as a result of it, and the sheer amount of damage we're seeing now in hindsight of the policies from that conference, permeating and trickling all the way down to the lowest levels of Catholic education as well. So please speak to that.
Yeah, and that is one of these turning points, and it's kind of interesting, the interpretation of it again that gets politicized. Critics of it say, oh, these Catholic educators capitulated to liberalism. and defenders of it say, Catholics adopted, you know, liberal education as the ideal because it's the best one. And I see it much more as a moment of Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
Where what they really, you know, they spoke this language, vaguely Newman-esque language of the idea of the university, but in the end, in their heart of hearts, what they wanted was to be accepted as Americans. And on that point, interesting kind of parallel to that, in the big controversy at Catholic U with Charles Curran and teaching about Humanae Vitae, you see pictures from that. You see people are carrying placards like, you know, freedom of religion in America. You know, they were defending Curran, not just on some kind of abstract academic freedom issue, excuse me, but as an explicitly American freedom of religion in America. We are free to say what we believe is true. And so they were, at this kind of a high Americanist moment, they were using that to justify Curran's freedom of speech and such. You know, again, that's, of course, a wrong interpretation, but it's very revealing that about this moment where it was all about, again, being American. And I think, again, the critics of that, I would consider myself one of the critics of that moment, but unlike most critics, I don't blame it on liberalism, which makes it kind of an easy target to kind of pigeonhole politically, but it's this general desire to be American, something that has, you know, afflicted American Catholics for, you know, some good and some bad reasons throughout history. Pope Leo the, now that we're talking about Leo and everything, Leo the 13th, who's, you know, known most for Rerum Novarum, but a few years after that, he circulated an apostolic letter, Testament of Valencia, where he condemned, I mean, it's a complicated document, but let's just say, simplicity's sake, he condemned this thing called Americanism.
Yep, he called it the heresy of Americanism.
And the, you know, what he meant at that time, again, was primarily the Protestantization of Catholicism. So, you know, truth is private judgment, and church structures must be, you know, egalitarian, democratic, and such like that. So, and that, you know, that wasn't, maybe a handful of theologians actually held those positions. So it wasn't a real problem for the American church in 1899, which was overwhelmingly immigrant. Oops.
Well, Chris, always a joy to connect with you. I greatly enjoy it. And, again, important conversation, and it's given us a lot of food for thought. Thank you for making the time.
Okay, well, great talking to you.
My guest, Dr. Christopher Shannon, member of the History Department at Christendom College, and he's been framing for us the reality that Catholics have had to grapple with being accepted and nationalism that resulted from that. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.